Hello and welcome back to Millennial. I'm now here with Robin Riley. Hello, Robin. Now, Robin has appeared every year since 2017, when she was known as Critical Condition, and also CC Bucko at one point. I can't quite remember the interaction between those two. But nowadays, Robin Riley, which I've always thought is a really cool name. It took me some time to get used to it because I liked Critical Condition, but Robin Riley is a very cool name. So. And every year you've come back and told people about the progress. You started as a, I'm not going to say stereotypical millennial, but you had a lifestyle, life story that was that is familiar to a lot of millennials.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you'd followed a lot of the notions of that age, of our age, and you found your way out of all of that. So. I don't know if you want, there's probably not much point summarizing the various steps because we've gone through them in previous years. And one person said in my own Telegram chat that it's nice to see each year as a sort of different installment when you come on and tell people what's going on now. So why don't you bring everyone up to date and welcome back to Millennial.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure to be here. So the past year has been really busy. I had my second child. I had a daughter in March of this past year. Her name is Marigold, and she is just the light of my life. I love having a daughter so much. I was really scared of having a daughter at first because my son, my firstborn, is just like, he's such a boy, and that's what I knew. And so having a girl just really felt like stepping into the unknown in a big way. But she has just been a dream come true in every possible way. And her birth was difficult, but it was also, it was at home. It was like, it was more painful than my first, but it was really what happened after her birth that was the significant thing. I found her birth to be totally transformative of my idea of what birth is. And that inspired me to, get my training as a doula, birth doula, which for anyone who doesn't know what that is, it's basically just like a traditional midwife. It's like a birth companion, someone who can help support women through the birth process in a variety of different ways, borrowing from lots of different traditions that are not really upheld in the medical system or at all. And I just got my final certification doing postpartum support work. So I now I'm certified through the birth, the pregnancy, the birth process, and into postpartum. I've been trained in how to support women. And so that's been a lot to take on while having a two-year-old and a now nine-month-old. But I'm extremely passionate about it. And I'm planning on continuing to, you know, get some more certifications and different types of training under my belt so that when I am in a different season of life and I'm not, you know, this full-time stay-at-home mom, wife, I have something that I can do that's meaningful to me and purposeful. And I think is something that, yeah, it just makes me really happy to be able to give to women what I've had, which is beautiful home births, completely natural and not meddled with or sabotaged in any capacity.
All right. A few questions arise. Mm-hmm. Is it not? I don't know. I'm a complete layman in all of this. Is it not more usual that the first birth is the more difficult one?
It depends on the woman. It really depends on the woman. I mean, that's. I guess some people would say that like the second birth, third birth can be quicker. The first births tend to be longer, and that was true for me, but longer doesn't necessarily mean harder. For example, in my first birth, it was, I think around eight to nine hours long from beginning to end. But, during the pushing phase, I had no pain, which was very surprising to me. And it was just beautiful, completely pain-free. I didn't feel out of control. It was a birth in water. My son cried as soon as he was born, and it was just perfect in every capacity. And I'm not saying the birth of my daughter wasn't perfect, but it was excruciating. It was so, so painful. And I think that there was nothing about my second birth that was pain-free. And I think partially that was because leading up to my first birth, I had spent a year training in the gym, you know, building myself up nutritionally, prepping for birth. But I got pregnant at 15 months postpartum with my daughter, and I was still breastfeeding my son at the time. So I was very depleted, and I had kind of, you know, been in survival mode, minding my first child all on my own. You know, entering motherhood during the pandemic when you have no support system was just grueling. And so my second pregnancy, I went into in a week, I was weaker, you know, in every capacity, weaker mentally, weaker emotionally, weaker physically. I'm sure my nutrient and mineral reserves were quite low at the time. And so the pregnancy was harder on my body. And I was less prepared for birth because I was, you know, minding a toddler all day long. I didn't have the luxury of spending all day just sort of getting into my birth bubble and educating myself and, you know, getting excited. It was very much a survival thing. So, and I think the speed of my second birth, like with Marigold, she was born in 4 hours from beginning to end of the birth process. And so I theorize that like the hormonal symphony that happens inside a woman when she's giving birth to a baby, if you have a shorter amount of time, I think steps can kind of get skipped. And I don't think my body had enough time to really get into that that state where the hormones are giving you a pain relief, like that high oxytocin state. And so it just all kind of, I felt like I was put into a blender. You know, I just felt totally out of control the entire time. Thankfully, I had an incredible traditional midwife supporting me through all of it. And, you know, it was, when I look back on it, it's still just an amazing birth experience, but different.
And you said that it had a transformative effect on how you think about birth. Could you elaborate on that?
So the conditioning that I think all women have, especially in the West, that birth is a medical event, and that it's inherently dangerous and that it needs to be managed by medical professionals, is something that, even though I was instinctually drawn to home birth and natural birth, I was still absolutely affected by. And there were still certain assumptions that I was making about birth, especially after my first birth, that affected the way that I felt about it. Like, I remember saying after my birth with Magnus that I was lucky. And I felt like I had won the lottery of birth, and there was no way that I was going to be able to be so lucky a second time round. And I was kind of assuming that something bad would happen the second time round, because I was thinking, you can't have two perfectly natural births with no intervention and no medical intervening. And that was due to my underlying belief, even after having a beautiful, perfect home birth, that birth was a medical event. And it's not. I no longer believe that. And there's a lot of steps that I took that brought me to that conclusion through the birth with Marigold. I started off with midwives who were regulated, and I went with regulated midwives because I was still afraid of birth, even though I had done it and I had done it successfully. I was still afraid of this unknown journey that pregnancy and bringing a new life into this world is. And I wanted to hand over the responsibility of that to a professional so that the weight of that wasn't fully in my hands. And I was kind of given a wake-up call around my third trimester when my midwife started to harass me to get the Rona jab. So I obviously didn't want that and told them in no uncertain terms that it wasn't going to happen. And then they started to use certain manipulation tactics, coercive tactics, fear-mongering me, threatening to withhold access to home birth if I didn't take it, because I was putting them in danger by not taking this experimental jab. And so in desperation, I used my social media platforms to seek out someone who was working outside the system, so an unregulated midwife, and I switched to her. And it was meeting her and through experiencing birth with this traditional midwife and later being educated as a doula by her, because she trains doulas, that my eyes were open to the fact that birth is a physiological process that works majority of the time, as long as it's not being sabotaged and meddled with and interfered on. And it took a lot of work and like actual structured education to bring me to that point. But that's the transformation that occurred, was that I finally now understand, I feel like I understand what birth is. And I understand that that wisdom, that deep wisdom inside of us that grows a baby, is the same wisdom that births a baby.
So you've also seen two extremes of birth. You've had the first one, which was very easy, pain-free, and then the second, which was the opposite extreme of that. So that probably gives you a sense of the scope of this phenomenon.
Totally.
With regard to the I've forgotten what you said, the professional midwife, I'm not sure of the terminology, but the sort of mainstream. You said that, and I've heard other people say this as well, in Britain, in Australia, and in America and Canada, I've heard people say that the way that birth is handled in hospitals is unnecessarily stressful and
it's barbaric.
In clinical and inhuman. Yes. I mean, what would you have to say about that? And why is this? And it's ridiculous that at this point we don't know how to do this well.
That's such a complex question to answer, but and you know, part of me wants to just say these people are all idiots that don't understand birth, but it's not that. And I think so. The success of the birth and a living baby and a living mother at the end of the birth process is on medical staff's hands who are, you know, not educated in what physiological birth actually looks like. They've never seen a natural birth from beginning to end. They desperately want you to have a living baby at the end of the process. And they feel probably traumatized by their own experiences in hospital. They've probably seen those outlier situations where something has completely gone wrong or everything has gone wrong. And the devastating tragedy of, you know, the loss of a newborn is just something that I can't think of anything worse personally. So in an attempt to avoid, you know, not only that happening, but of the weight of the responsibility being on their hands and the liability that's associated with that, they do everything that they can to control the situation. They're constantly thinking, oh, well, this could go wrong, so we're going to do this. We're going to preempt this thing that could possibly go wrong by doing XYZ, and then XYZ actually ends up causing a whole host of other problems. And so I think it's the main reason why the medical model of birth and obstetrics in general doesn't really work, is because it's directed by fear rather than by trust in women, and trust in women's bodies. And I mean, it's funny, you know, the same parts of the medical sector, which, you know, just went along with the whole Rona nonsense, that also was guided by fear, right? And there was a coercive element to that, in the same way that women are coerced into doing certain things in birth. You know, if you don't do this, someone's going to die. You're going to die. You wouldn't want that to happen, right? And so, you know, when you're in that fight or flight response, women just want their babies to be alive, and they go along with things that they probably wouldn't if they were in a different situation. And outcomes are pretty bad right now. Like in the United States, I think it's 1 in 3 pregnancies end in a cesarean section. And if you look at the way these stats have risen over time, like there's no reason for that except for just medical meddling.
It's preemptive. This is something I've heard, that it's something that they almost do willy-nilly now. And I don't really know, I mean, what is the justification for that? Is it in case she gets injured?
What's the reason for the cesarean section?
Yeah.
So there's lots of different reasons. The thing that everyone in the medical community is most afraid of is this thing called shoulder dystocia, which is when the shoulder of the baby doesn't, one of the shoulders of the baby doesn't clear the pelvis, and sometimes is hooked under the pelvis on the way out. I've seen loads of videos of women's births where it's clearly not a shoulder dystocia. And there's different ways that we can identify this as a midwife. You know, like if the baby's head is born to the chin, the shoulders have passed. the pelvis, and it's not a shoulder dystocia. But sometimes, because there is a wide range of normal when it comes to physiological birth, maybe the head is born, and then it takes a few minutes for the body to come out. Sometimes when the head is born, the body just slips out, but sometimes it doesn't, and there's nothing wrong with that. And we can just let women have the time to get their baby out if we don't panic and see that as a potential shoulder dystocia. And you'll see women having, like, you know, someone reaching into them and hauling their baby out, right? Which can cause permanent pelvis damage and terrible tears and all sorts of stuff. And if they had been trained properly, they would know that a shoulder dystocia can be identified by only a head only being half born. And oftentimes the head will come out just a little bit and then it will go back in, type thing. And that's when you would have to use certain techniques to release the baby. And for a medical person, that would often be taking a knife and cutting the woman open and then vacuuming the baby out, or using forceps, which also has a ton of issues with it. I was trained in a really gentle method where you can just insert your fingers at the baby's ears and until you reach the shoulders, and you gently rock the shoulders back and forth, which will cause minimal tearing and minimal damage to the woman. Oftentimes, like, based on what my mentors told me, 99% of the time, the baby's shoulder will unlock with that rocking motion, and the baby will corkscrew out because of all this sort of built up pressure behind the baby. And doctors aren't taught that. they're taught medical solutions to these problems rather than more gentle and less invasive solutions to these problems. And so that would be like one reason, maybe, that they would say, oh, your baby's too big and we're afraid of a shoulder dystocia. So a shoulder dystocia wouldn't have even happened yet, but just because of a faulty ultrasound reading, oh yeah, your baby is reading like 12 pounds or 11 pounds. We're going to have a induction and then a cesarean section to prevent a shoulder dystocia. And that would be really common, like way more common than you would assume it to be.
Mm. And of course, I'm guessing that money is also involved here.
Of course.
Yeah, from the insurance. Yeah. Gosh. But of course, it doesn't need to be just money. You know, like the NHS in Britain will do this stuff as well. And you know, they're not getting more money for it, as far as I know, anyway. A lot of it is, and this goes for other things. I mean, all sorts of things in medical problems where they've got a way of dealing with it, and that way is the only way. It becomes the gospel. It's just, this is what we do. This is the solution. We know what to do. And a sort of dogma emerges. And then, of course, they'll teach their students, their underlings, that this is the only way to do it. And so that it becomes this thing. I mean, it's really ridiculous. And you would think that they would be more reflective about it, about all these matters. It's quite amazing, especially with something as just absolutely fundamental as childbirth. You'd think that they would always be looking for, and I'm sure they were at one point. I know that when the medical sector took over childbirth from amateurs centuries ago, the infant mortality rate was immediately reduced because they were looking for more. They were having an open mind, looking for ways to improve the process. But I think that everything gets ossified after a while, and you end up with just, as I say, dogma. But let's move on to a cheerier topic, which I think you'll probably enjoy speaking about more. Which is, and it's not that I'm not that I guess this. I just think that there's something else that I think you would much more prefer to talk about.
Yes, sir.
You've now had a boy baby and a girl baby.
Yes.
Are they different?
Oh my goodness, yes. In every single way. It's just wild how different they are. And what's really interesting is that my son seems to be more like me, and my daughter seems to be more like my husband. So when just the behavioral differences are just super apparent. You know, my son is like a bull in a china shop, and my daughter is very reserved and delicate in all of her movements and very just sort of observant and very embodied, even at a very young age. Whereas my son is quite brutish. Like he's very a masculine little toddler. But with my son, it was like when he was born, it was like I just immediately recognized him on a deep spiritual level. I was just like, I know you. You're just I can see myself in you, in your spirit. And I was a very rambunctious little girl, but my husband is more, I guess, like calm and collected and reserved. And he's Eastern European. So he has this kind of like Eastern European demeanor. And I can see that that's in my daughter. And when I look at her sometimes and just see how she is, she's just a complete mystery to me, because there are ways that she's so different from me, I feel like, in just really beautiful ways. So there's that. And there's things that my daughter does that my son never did. Like my daughter likes to open up drawers and just kind of fling things. And I'm like, I kind of do that when I'm getting ready. Maybe this is a girl thing. And I've checked with my other friends who have girls, and they indeed do this thing where they like to open drawers and just things over the shoulder, whereas my son never did that, ever. My son smiled a lot later. He was like more interested in like if you picked him up, he'd be like, bring me over there, I want to see that thing. Bring me over there, I want to see that thing. We'd pick up this thing and just start whacking something. Like, that's how he was. Whereas my daughter has, she waves and she smiles. She smiled at like six or 8 weeks, I think, or even earlier than that. It's a bit of a blur now, but way earlier than he did. And she, whenever she sees someone and makes eye contact with them, she smiles and gives a big wave. Whereas like my son, he would wave at trucks. Like he would wave at the garbage truck and like construction trucks and stuff like that, but not so much people. So even at these like super young ages, there are very clear differences between boys and girls, in my opinion. They're just unmistakable.
Yeah. And of course, that's not because you're socializing them differently.
No, it's absolutely innate. And also, I am socializing them. I am. Like, I totally am. I want my girl to be, I want her to understand what it means to be a girl. And I want her to understand what it means to be a woman someday. And so, like, I will say, you know, this is a girl thing. This is a boy thing. You know, sure, there can be some exceptions. But for the most part, this is a girl thing. This is a boy thing, you know, and
it's absolutely amazing. It's amazing to think that they wouldn't be told that at school these days. Yeah. They would be told the opposite. I mean, you know, you and I are pretty much similar age, and we can remember when that was the norm at school. You know, there were girls, even in toy shops. I mean, there have been various stories about toy stores. Like I think, Hamlin's in London was one of them, where they've done away with the boy toys and girl toys, different aisles for I mean, it's just incredible. And I'm sure that this must do a lot. I'm sure that it must do damage.
Of course. Yeah. Because at these like tender young ages, they are just following their instincts. They're trying to find out who they are by just following a totally innocent drive inside of them. And if you have an adult saying those drives are useless, they're not actually giving you knowledge about yourself. If you are doing things which to them seem stereotypically masculine or feminine, they're going to pathologize that in a very small child that's just like trying to figure out the world and stuff. So of course it's damaging. There's no way it couldn't be.
No, exactly. There is no way that it could be. You know, one of the cliches that even I know about this, the differences between male and female babies, is that boys are interested in things, whereas girls are interested in people. Mm-hmm. That does seem to be already proven by what you said, how your son would wave at trucks.
Yeah.
I think that's hilarious. But the idea is that there is a sort of an interest in socializing and in interacting with people, engaging facial expressions and communicating with people, whereas boys are looking at mechanical stuff. And
absolutely.
Which is, again, it's amazing that this emerges so quickly. But I've heard from quite a few different parents that this is something that's almost immediately apparent. What would you have to say about that?
Well, see, the thing is like at this young age as well, like my son is a boy, like there's no doubt about that. But he doesn't really know what it means to be a boy, right? And so there have been some there have been some occasions where, like, if he sees his sister is getting a cuddle from me, right, or I'm doing her hair, I'm giving her some kind of special attention, that he would like that attention. He'll, you know, he would be like, oh, I'm a girl now, so let me have that attention, right? And there have been very specific times where that's occurred. And the really scary thing is that that's all it takes. That's all it would take for some parents to completely derail this child's life, and, you know, which obviously ends up in mutilation, sterilization, and a whole host of horrific, nightmarish things. And if you feed into that, like if I actually said to my son, you know, yes, you are a girl, and I like egged it on and like was incentivizing it, like, yeah, of course he's going to like, you know, latch on to that, right? Like it's so clearly manipulation on behalf of the parents. And I see that now even more clearly when I'm seeing my son being vulnerable in those moments where what he really wants is just a connection, right? And he has mistaken getting the connection. Like I'm giving my daughter the attention because she's a girl. And so in order to get the attention, okay, well, I'm going to be a girl too, so I can get the attention, rather than, you know, what another person might think, which is that, oh, you know, time to destroy my child's life.
Yeah, yeah. it is remarkable, because there will be a thousand things, thousand little opportunities throughout his childhood where something will, he'll say something, or he'll not say something, or he'll do or not do something, or he'll take an interest in something, that a misguided parent could see any one of those thousand different things as the starting point.
Yes.
And then you get onto this, as you say, this nightmare roller coaster, which will then be accelerated by the powers that be, by the authorities and whatever. And indeed, in the worst case scenario, they'll even take it out of the parents' hands by force, so as to keep the child on that course. I mean, it's absolutely horrendous. And, you know, I just really hope, I'm not going to Fed post, but I really hope that one day justice is done through due course of law and so on.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, here in Canada, it's pretty bad, especially in British Columbia, and it's pretty bleak. Like there's no chance of my children ever being able to go to public school. You know, like I don't want to raise my children to be sheltered from the world and then craving, you know, what I'm prohibiting from them. So, you know, I think by the time that they're teenagers, I will have been able to educate them on these matters well enough so that if it's something that they choose to go into a public school, maybe I would allow it. I don't know. I'm still kind of thinking about whether or not that would be a good idea, you know? Because as an Orthodox Christian, we're not supposed to shelter our children from the world. We're supposed to be in the world. We're just not allowed to be of the world, right? That's the main difference. And so it makes me really sad to think that like there are certain quintessential experiences of coming of age that my children will be denied because the world's become so inhospitable to just like living a normal life the way that I did when I was growing up. Even just being on the playground, you know, you can really tell that I'm living in a liberal place by the types of kids that he has as options for friends. Just in the general public, it's very limited, you know, and that makes me really sad. But I'm hoping that with like diligent homeschooling and making sure that, you know, I'm raising them in the church and our home is a holy place, that they will be guided by that, and they will see me as someone who is introducing them to the world in a way that's critical and moral, and it's not stifling. And then they'll be able to go out and do the Lord's work as adults, ideally.
I mean, I think one thing is you probably want to show them, help them to see why you're not putting them into that situation.
Yes.
So you want them to see how messed up and confused and degenerate the mainstream is. Then they'll understand. It won't be a sort of, I mean, I don't want to give you advice. I don't know anything about this, but I'm just saying from my perspective as a layman, this would seem like the way to go about it, because you don't want them to resent you for that, obviously.
Not at all. Not at all. I don't want them to like growing like that sort of story, that same story that even kind of affected me growing up, of this like feeling very sheltered, feeling very caged in by my parents, and living in a very small place that was boring. And I really hope to be able to, I mean, a lot of these dreams have been dashed because of the pandemic, but I would love to be able to travel the world with my children and use the world as our classroom and, you know, bring them to loads of different European places and ideally even have a summer home somewhere on the Slovenian Riviera. Those are my like my wildest dreams. And, you know, they won't have this feeling of like, you know, my parents are keeping me from the world. Hopefully I will be able to show them that I'm keeping them from the things that are actively targeting them and will lead to great harm if they engage with it, and showing them all the wonderful things about the world at the same time.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of questions.
Sure.
LD asks, Robin, how many children do you think you will have?
Oh, so this is a tough question because it really changes from day to day. Like some days I'm having a really, really hard day. I'm like, I'm done. Like I'm maxed out. I started too late. Like I'm in my mid 30s now. And I unfortunately wasted my 20s, and I'm working on a shorter timeline than a younger woman might have. And also, like, you know, your body is not as strong, and you're not as, you know, you don't have the same vitality in your 30s as what you did in your 20s. And so there are some days where I'm like, I think I'm maxed out for now. I'll revisit this question when my youngest is 2 years old. And then there are other days where, you know, things just work and the routine unfolds beautifully, and I feel like super mom, and I'm like, all right, we're going for five again. Let's do it. Like I can do this. And we started off, me and my husband started off wanting five children. Five was like our ideal number. That was the number that we were going to go for. But now, like, the reality of how challenging being a parent is and raising children is, it's just humbled us greatly. And so I'm saying I'm going to take it one at a time. And when Marigold is 2 years old, I am certain that I will try for a third. Will I try for a fourth? I don't know. We'll have to wait until the third is 2 years old, and then I'll see what I can do. Because I made the mistake of getting pregnant before weaning my first. And nursing a child while you're pregnant is, it's like the Olympics of motherhood, in my opinion. And I did it. Like, I totally did it. And I'm so proud of myself, but I will never do it again. I totally am in awe of the women who can nurse while pregnant, and they just like rock it, and they just don't, they're unbothered by it. I can't do it again. So I have to think about how thin I'm spreading myself. And the other factor, which is, determining this, the answer to this question, is that I have become like very aware of the fact that there's less of me for my second than there was for my first. With my first, they got all of me all day long, right? Magnus was my world for those 2 years until his sister was born. And there are certain things about his personality that I think were shaped by the fact that he had all of my attention. There's like, he has this firstborn kind of persona a little bit, where he thinks everything revolves around him, and it does. Whereas my daughter has never known a world where I am fully so focused on her. She's always had her little crazy brother doing laps around her and me trying to like put out fires around the house while cooking. And like, you know, she's never had my full attention. And so she actually is just naturally a little more independent than he ever was. She's fine. She doesn't need me there all the time. And so that's great. But I also sometimes feel like a little sad. I'm like, gosh, I wish I could just spend some alone time with my little baby, but I can't because I have a toddler to take care of too. And I'm sure that that feeling of being spread thinner and thinner, and there's less of me to devote to my children as I gain a bigger family, will only intensify. So I don't want to just, you know, go for the biggest number possible at the expense of my children and what I can give them, right? And I really think that that's important to consider, and it's why I'm taking it one kid at a time for now on. So we're aiming for five, Minimum three. I'd be happy with four.
That sounds good. That does sound good. All right. Another question. What do you think about the argument? And then we've talked about this earlier a bit, but mm-hmm. what do you think about the argument that kids benefit from going to kindergarten from like 1 year of age? How do you plan to socialize them?
Well, so this is it's like this, the question that homeschool people are always, thrown at, like that there's the only way to socialize your child is to throw them into like basically a cage match with a bunch of other children who are being supervised by a disinterested, underpaid, babysitter, you know, who's just going to like, okay, here's an educational activity. Here's another. That's like, children are socialized in so, so many different ways. And even my 2-year-old, like he's enrolled in gymnastics. We go to indoor playgrounds. He's going to be taking swimming soon. He's going to be taking martial arts when he turns 3. We go to church sometimes 2-3 times a week. He has a huge family, who are, I'm so blessed to have family on both sides that want to be involved with my children's lives. Like my brother is here right now helping out, and my children are obviously, they're being influenced by their family members too. And then also I have loads of friends. Like I am a really social person and I have lots of mom friends, some inside the church, some on the periphery. I'm trying to like usher them in. We'll see what happens. But they have children too. And so we have play dates. Imagine that, you know, you can set up a time for another child to come to your house so that your kid can play with another kid. There's lots of different ways that your children can get socialized. And this myth that the best way to socialize your child is with state, you know, government approved goons with a bunch of like children who have been like abandoned to the state for their education by their full-time working parents, I think it's laughable. It's totally laughable. And when we think about like what public schools actually become,
oh like, God, yes.
There is such a thing as being over-socialized too. And I think that we're seeing this a little bit in Gen Z, you know, this like TikTok culture of like just constantly wanting eyes on you, the performative element of it. You know, everyone's an influencer now. Like there is an element of being over-socialized, and there's so much more to being a mature, wise, healthy adult than whether or not you are entertaining to have a conversation with, in my opinion. And I do think my kids will be able to do that anyway.
yeah. Certainly. This is also why I hope that working from home becomes more of a thing. And you know, after COVID, that seems to have been the case. And I hope it continues, because if parents are at home all the time by default, then they can these kinds of interactions that you're talking about are much more possible. They don't have to send their kids to daycare, and they can also have other people's kids over, and they can interact and play and all that. So it just seems, again, it's actually going back to a more traditional way of being, where people they didn't go to the factory or the plant or whatever it was to make a living. I really do hope that remains the case.
Yeah, my husband works from home, and it's a dream come true. It's an absolute dream come true. My children have both their parents at home. Like, what a blessed life. You know, like I wouldn't have even dreamed of that even being possible. That's like the one good thing that's come out of the past. You know, the COVID era is the working from home thing, because we just love having my husband around all the time. And I know my kids definitely do too.
Yeah, I bet they do. Of course, it also means a whole lot of other things, like that you don't have to do everything yourself. It's easier to organize things and all that. Definitely. Okay. One final question. It's a bit different. I suspect I know the answer to this.
Okay.
Is Robin keeping up with the reemergence of Jordan Peterson?
Oh my gosh. You know, I saw a promoted like Daily Wire like ad on Instagram the other day, and he was literally wearing a Two-Face suit. Like, you know, Two-Face from Batman, and it's like, oh, he's wearing a suit that's supposed to symbolize heaven and hell. Oh, it's like so dark and brooding. It's like, no, he's literally become a Batman villain. Like the guy is so dark. Like there's something so dark and like grifty about him now. And
but also demented.
Yeah, he just really doesn't seem... I feel so bad saying anything negative about him because anyone who's followed my journey knows that like I owe a huge amount of gratitude for him for being one of the catalysts of my transformation from being like a degenerate to having this blessed life that I have now. But you know, when you look at lectures of Jordan Peterson, he's like back before he became famous, like he's like full of this energy and he's passionate and there's this optimism and he's like dropping truth bombs on you and he's just jovial. You know, there's something that's electric about him in those classroom videos. And now you look at him and he's like it's like dark, shadowy, like weird, like just... He's just intense, in the tentacles of Daily Wire.
Yeah, and intense and tortured and tormented. Yeah. That's how he seems all the time now. And the stuff he's coming out with is just insane. But let's not get into the politics. I just wanted to keep it nice and sweet here with this one.
Let's all pray that he becomes Orthodox. Because I think Jonathan Paggio has been doing some really good work to try and bring him into the church. And that like association, I think, is really positive for him. So I'm just going to keep praying that he sees the light and he comes home.
All right. Excellent. Well, I didn't ask you much about the birth doula.
And
what that means, but you did talk about it. If there's anything else you'd like to say about that before we finish.
I don't know if you... I gave you my Instagram link to put in the description, correct?
I think so.
Okay, so my ad on Instagram is bridgids.cross. Anyone who is trying to conceive or is currently pregnant and you would like a digital doula, I'm offering that service. You can contact me through Instagram, and I'm taking like video consultations where if you have questions about anything, you need like... it's really hard for women to find someone to talk to who just trusts birth and trusts them to birth their babies. From the minute they get pregnant, you know, till the minute the baby is born in hospital, they're surrounded by people who are distrusting of them and who are putting these sort of seeds of doubt in their head that, you know, if it all works out, it's only, you know, by the grace of God and our medical expertise that it happens. Like there's an alternate side to this. And if I unfortunately, because my lifestyle doesn't allow me to be on call at this stage, I can't offer that support digitally. And so if you're looking for any kind of support with anything birth and pregnancy related, please feel free to reach out to me via Instagram. You can DM me and we can set up like a Skype or whatever. And I'm happy to help. That's why I did it. That's why I got trained, so I could help women and men out there who are trying to build their families.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And that's a lovely way to end there, because when you think about how it started and where you are now, it's a really lovely continuum. So, all right. Well, Robin Riley, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial 8. We had to rearrange it a few times, but we got there in the end.
We got there.
I'm really glad. I'm really glad that
Me
we got
too.
To do this.
Thank you so much, Rose. It was such a good time.
All right. I'm glad. All right. I'll be back imminently with Black Pilled. Thank you for waiting for that. The schedule's been a bit protracted tonight for various reasons, technical stuff, but it's all done. We're on track. So, okay, Robin Riley, I've really enjoyed this. So thank you very much.
Okay. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Okay. Merry Christmas to you and your family as well. Okay. I'll be back soon. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.